Welcome to Humboldt County Grown, the podcast that digs into the dirt, the dreams, and the daily lives of farmers here in Humboldt County, California. Today, we're exploring a project that blends regenerative agriculture, cultural revitalization, and economic justice in Humboldt County. Our guests today are
Octavio Acosta,
Adriana Salgado,
and Oscar Muglione.
From Keeley Metzley Masa Co-op, a cooperative uniting farmers, artisans, and consumers around the traditional practices of the Milpa, the ancestral Three Sisters agroecological system. Octavio, Oscar, and Adriana, thank you so much for joining us. Let's like get right into it. To start, can you share the origin story behind Keeley Metzley? What inspired this project, and what does the name signify?
Yeah, this project started because we all saw that there was a need in the community to and a potential to have the Latino community up here have access to land, have access to traditional agriculture, and being indigenous communities, that's kind of our connection to the land is the basis of all of our culture. So, I think we all had a yearning to connect people to the land, and for me, it was in hopes of also, cultivating more culture. You know, if we have the raw materials, if we have the produce, that our cultures are based on, then we have the raw materials to cultivate a vibrant culture that includes the arts, culinary, equestrian, and everything that comes with it. And then I'll let Adriana continue that story.
Yeah, I think this is a dream a lot of people have had. It's, corn and beans are things we eat every day. They're just so staple. So many people we've talked to say they've grown up dreaming about the same thing, that access to the land, that fresh food, the things that their grandparents did. And when we decided to choose a name for this project, we wanted something in indigenous language. A lot of people in our group are Mexica, so we went with a Nahuatl word. We're looking for something around corn, and something with the color red. The color red is such a strong meaning for the indigenous movement. The Red New Deal is a strong project that's in the back of our mind when we're thinking about these things. This the land back movement and bringing indigenous ways back into our ideology and our everyday practices. Mm-hmm. So red both signifies this, deeply ingrained movement of survival that's been happening in this country since colonization. And also just like the labor movement, red is such a strong color.
Mm-hmm.
The red brings these two ideas together that are something that is strongly seated in our project's ways of being. We're here to provide living wages. That's our goal,
mm-hmm.
For farmers. It's such a radical idea,
right.
Just that basic living wage. And then we went for moon because the moon is the rising tide. Keeley Metzley means red corn moon. And there is this shift in the U.S., this rise of indigenous voices that are reclaiming, these spaces that have been taken over by colonialism. And, we wanted to have that symbol that of change, of this new way of being.
Mm-hmm.
That new generation farmer, right? And understanding that here are all these people that can try their best to uphold a section of land or a plot of land, but without this sense of community, without being able to tap into all of our shared information, shared resources, we wouldn't be able to get as far as we've been able to get without that. And so surfacing that centering it and allowing community members and students to get involved and opening our doors has really allowed us to see the impact, right? The impact of this horizontal, more, you know, streamlined approach as opposed to sticking to your guns and doing it at your best means. And I've seen a lot of farmers take that route and be able to scale it over time. And now they're on a larger scale. However, it seems like we can't really wait anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like we've been in this community for some time. We see the dots, and so connecting them has allowed us to benefit from this impact, to get more done together, to
mm-hmm.
be collaborative, and forming this co-op, we hope can serve as an incubator, right? That people can then benefit from to continue their skill sets that maybe come from their homeland that they didn't think they could surface here because it's not economically feasible. That economic feasibility is now, it's on all of us. It's not just on one person or just one component of their offering. It's all of our offerings together for the betterment of the community and a robust food system.
I see how it's a matter of people recognizing that you have struggles in common and there's a gap in culture and there's a gap in knowledge. And I love that, especially with the name, Akili Metzli. I knew it was of indigenous origin, but I didn't know how weighted each word was there, red corn moon. And so I like that it's able to recognize indigenous culture and struggle and history and labor struggle as well. And you're, like you're saying, yeah, there is not a lot of options or time right now, or the economic situation for looking right now is not so great for a lot of small farmers. So it's a lot of people don't have that option to just go on their own. And you kind of have to band together. And it makes me think of the MIUPA system, which is what I want to ask about next. Can you talk a bit about the MIUPA system? Because I understand it's more than just the three sisters, corn, bean, squash. It's also a cultural tool. Can you speak more on that?
Yeah, I always say that it's not just the three sisters, it's the 500 cousins. And, you know, I think in the traditional MIUPA, depending on the regions that they're cultivated in, there are, you know, medicinal herbs, there's plants for materials, and kind of everything grows in there, everything that produces any sustenance, material, or medicine. And I think with the modernization of agriculture, you know, came in, you know, monocropping, also pesticides, and kind of like this very patriarchal way of just seeing the value in the most valuable produce and getting rid of everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But in getting rid of everything else, we also got rid of the community inside of the MIUPAs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like a poisonous ground, and, you know, kids shouldn't go in and play in the fields because there's, you know, pesticides everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the men or the women, depending on different gender roles in different communities. But, you know, there's no more medicinal herbs growing alongside the corn, so, you know, you exclude a different sector of our community from, you know, going into a MIUPA and accessing, you know, plants for medicine and stuff like that. So I think in re-diversifying our agriculture, we're allowing access to our community to come back again and to, you know, have access to that land. And, you know, it's been beautiful to see that, you know, there's been ceremony at our work parties. There have been, you know, kids playing, kids learning about planting, and community just coming together.
I like that the diversity of the farm or the MIUPA kind of offers tools for everybody, or has something, medicine and food, but also gives roles for everybody, so everyone can participate and actually be a part of their food system.
And, you know, in most indigenous cultures, there is this connection to land. Land is culture. And one of the big differences between like our modern Western colonial culture and, you know, even past European indigenous cultures, like this was very global way of thinking, but you lived with the land, you were affected by the land, you spaced your time through the seasons based on what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas colonialism, you sit on top of the land and you never interact, you dominate.
Right.
And the Milpa is really that full, my culture and my land are so intertwined you can't disconnect them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's every aspect of life. You have, the Milpa doesn't have to have corn. It is this ideology of gardening where there's tending, but it's not such an isolated, we're taking these seeds and, you know, we're hiding them away and protecting their genomes and everything. It's very integrated. And it can include the forest, you know, it can include so many wild plants, not just the small herbs, but bushes and shrubs. And, you know, you get everything. You get your whatever building material, whatever art material, crafting material, it fruits, you know. One of my big goals is to figure out how to do the forest gardening here in Humboldt.
I was just thinking forest gardening as well. It seems like one of those things where you hear this a lot in the permaculture world, where you see a lot of systems of cultivation that people have actually been doing for a very long time and have sprang up independently in different cultures across the world. Mm-hmm. And I can kind of see those systems being very similar because they are from that pre-colonial, pre-industrial time where you didn't have that dominance over nature and you had to be more in tune with it to survive or to thrive.
Well, there's this reciprocity in working with the land, using Milpa agronomy. It's like recognizing, oh, okay, like this part of the land has more water, like it's retaining, and the corn is shorter here. Why is that? Where the corn is higher, we want to plant things like basil next to it for shading. And so there's a lot of like back and forth listening to the land, like what is developing, how is it developing, and how are we adjusting,
mm-hmm.
right? How are we making these adjustments to support what is happening in front of us? And so when Raul and I go out to the Hupa site, when we get there, first thing we do is we just walk the land and we just notice.
Yeah.
We just take it in as it is. And then we make our judgments on what we had, like a predisposed plan based off our walk around, right? So it changes.
Mm-hmm.
So we could go in there with the intention of doing trellising and then realize, oh, our tomatoes aren't actually, you know, needing this much trellising right now. Maybe we should focus more on these little furrows that get overgrown with weeds or the moles, right?
Right.
Poke holes in them. And so There's this constant reciprocity of like, okay, this is happening, now we respond.
Mm-hmm.
And as we respond, things happen as well.
And
so that's been a really healing process. Like, it's slow down, focus. It's been a journey. And in that journey, we formed a relationship.
Yeah.
Right?
It makes me think of a phrase I've heard in the horticulture world, which is, your plants are talking, are you listening?
Mm-hmm.
And I could see it with Keely Metzley, it's more like your land is talking, are you listening?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of what you're doing there when you get to the farm with Raul. You're taking a moment to listen to the land, see what it's saying to you, and respond accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
And we know a lot of like our cultural plants, and I think part of our task now as like really digging into the Milpa ideology of tending, like we need to now learn all the wild plants. You know, what do you do when the huckleberry comes up in your Milpa? How do you make sure that is tended to? You know,
yeah.
when the wild plants out here, not just herbs, but, you know, the shrubs, how do we include berries into our Milpas here?
Mm-hmm.
How do we, you know, is there a way to include the redwoods and these cycles of, you know, opening small plots, letting them return to the forest and start, you know, this continual cycle of rotations of land, because I mean that's the goal of the Milpa in the long run, is this as a ecologist I think of of succession and and how that really benefits the health of a forest when done in small portions. And that was that's what the milpa is. We come in and we create destruction so that things can grow up. And while we allow those things to grow up, we grow, you know, our daily crops.
Right. And I think that's another thing that comes in conflict with the industrial or colonial view of things, where if you're establishing a business or a farm, in part the idea is kind of like this is going to be here forever, or it's just going to keep growing until it can't anymore. And I think that the idea of like starting a farm or cultivation system that's somewhat controlled or different from the environment around it, and then knowing it's going to go back to a forest one day and having that planned out, I don't think that goes with a lot of modern farming techniques. And that's kind of like, again, it speaks to that disconnection from nature, and that idea that you can have so much dominance over nature that you can just like have a farm in one piece of land and continue to extract resources out of that soil indefinitely. It's in the short term seems like something that might be possible, but you know, cultures and time proves otherwise. I wanted to ask about how you work with each other, the cooperative aspect of Achille Metzli, how you work on each other's farms or share knowledge.
This group started with some I have a lot of experience in community organizing up here, and you know, the core things that we started off were agreements, because we're dealing with people, you know, also. And so I feel like a core of our agreements were, you know, are based on respect and accountability, and even, you know, thinking about the milpa and the diversity in that, it's, you know, it's not just the diversity in our work parties, but it's also the diversity in our connections outside of this. You know, we're trying to work with the local indigenous communities to ensure that we're doing things in the right way. You know, if we're out in Hoopa, making sure that we're doing things in the right way, and all these things have their learning curves. But you know, as long as we're always coming in with that respect and that accountability, I feel like we can, you know, really go far and really kind of help out the community, help out ourselves, and yeah, so respect and accountability are kind of the basis of all of our, you know, kind of social interactions, which include the work parties and
the organizing. And it's kind of like the way we've been received in the community at large, it's like we are being seen as a medium to have all these theories put into practice, right? And sometimes it feels challenging when you agree with these things, these ideologies, but you're a white presenting individual and you don't feel like it's your place to carry these things forwards. But when they come up, then we're starting to see a lot of immediate support, a lot of immediate backing, a lot of immediate recognizing of the value of what is being done here. And so that allows us to, you know, feel like we have motivation, you know, like we have integrity in what we're doing, and we don't feel isolated. Although this brainchild like formulated over, you know, like some meetings and, you know, getting together and group agreements, and now we're incorporating, the origin of this was really, don't you guys think this is cool? Yes, let's share it. As we shared it, people were like, this is actually amazing. How can we support it? Right? Like, how can we see it breathe, walk, run? And we're just not getting to that place of like visioning what that can look like in the future for our community at large.
Yeah, I guess it's a matter of like, once you know you have that much support, you know you're possible of getting good things done with this many people and this much support. And I've seen it in my time working with y'all, how quickly it's grown. It's been amazing to see in one season people start from being just working by themselves on their farms to having like a full, what looks like a pretty cool party every month, and you're getting a lot of work done. I'm like, wow, that's...
And eating good food.
So
much good food.
Adriana, can you speak to me a bit more about the cooperative aspect of Achille Metzli?
Yeah, for sure. Like with a lot of things in this project, we're very intentional about our choices and our actions. So deciding on a business structure was going to be central. As a very anti-capitalist group of people, the business side was always a conundrum. But then we came across co-ops. Cooperatives allow for a horizontal form of hierarchy where nobody's at the top. There's nobody that owns the business. The community owns the business, which is really important when we're thinking about a basic resource like masa and making sure that the community has access to this, the food sovereignty has access and control over a basic commodity.
Mm-hmm.
And that it continues. You know, about the time we started Achille Metzli was like when the tofu shop was closing and we had lost the slaughterhouse that year as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which are both community staples, but because they weren't a co-op, because they were run by a single person, when that person was ready to retire, we lost that. So being a co-op is part of how we're ensuring that the basics, the food sovereignty of our community is guaranteed through generations, while also ensuring that everybody who is a part of the Achille Metzli community has the education to engage with the business and with the community to be able to have a say. Everybody who's a part of a co-op gets to have a say in the money and how things are run.
Mm-hmm.
And co-ops, they don't necessarily value capital as their central value, which when we're talking about business, it's really hard to find a business where the bottom line isn't what is constantly drive them. With a co-op, we don't have... what do you call those people who meet?
Board. Shareholders.
We don't have shareholders who are asking for money, money, money. You know, it's a law in the U.S. where it's like shareholders have the final say. And
yeah.
But so with a co-op, it means that we all get a say. If there are extra money, we all get a piece of that. But the value doesn't have to be around capital.
Mm-hmm.
Because what keeps a co-op, afloat is the community's support.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it's really whatever value the community decides on. And that's what allows a co-op to be, you know, radical within capitalism, be a place to transverse capitalism, but also ensure that everybody can survive and continue to be supported in capitalism, because that's the biggest... that's the hardest hurdle to get over, is getting that money to ensure that you survive in capitalism while you can build new worlds and structures within it.
Yeah, it's certainly a challenge if you have that anti-capital stance in the middle of a very capitalistic country. That's how things work and run around here, but creating a new system within that doesn't take just figuring out the economics of it, but the mindset going into it and getting people who maybe haven't grown up or thought about things like that before to have those, or maybe people who don't realize how much capital is the bottom line of so many businesses and endeavors, and realizing there's other bottom lines as well. But again, in our economic system, that bottom line is profit. We hear about that in sustainable business, the triple bottom line, like people, planet, profit, but it's still, you still need profit before the people on the planet, unfortunately. But at least I like these models that split that profit so it's not just going to shareholders, that don't have any concern necessarily beyond that profit. It's going to everybody involved who is involved enough to be educated on what they're doing, and they have enough input and are affected enough by the co-op that they're willing to participate. And it's, I've had moments like that before working at sole proprietorships or corporations, especially large corporations I've worked for, where it's felt like, man, why do we value democracy so much outside of the workplace? But then in this workplace here, it seems like a feudal system or something. Like, it seems very, very not democratic working at this giant factory.
Yeah.
Well, there's this, like, yeah, you could, like, split dividends amongst people in your co-op, but there's also this understanding that conventionally people haven't had to have this much invested interest to do something like farming. You have farmers who become everything, right? They do their marketing, their accounting, their farming, they're spearheading projects at the farm or at the site. And it becomes overwhelming, right? And then that sense of community becomes absent. Like, you're over in Petrolia, or
yeah,
you're in Willow Creek, and you're isolated, and you're, you know, maybe your kids are going to college. Maybe they're not as interested in farming. And so there's also the challenges around being a co-op that, you know, there's more, you have to have more invested interest. You know, you have to be a voting member. You have to, you know, step up and say something. And we're in this world where we've been conditioned to be normal, to normalize the sense of, okay, there's the boss. This is my role. This is my agency. That's all I have to worry about. But within a horizontal sociocratic structure, there is going to be more voting. There is going to be more say, more stake, more investment, more reading if you are going to be, like, contributing at that front. And so recognizing that and anticipating it is going to allow us to not move so fast and to have that slowdown, that breakdown of what's happening so that people can contribute. That diversity will be incorporated into our growth, not because of it. So, like, there's a lot of, like, positive in going sociocratic, going horizontal, being a co-op. But there's definitely challenges because of the world that we're in, right? It's not the norm. It is asking a little more. But we believe that that ask is, like, in the best interest of that individual, as well as our overall, like, you know, structure, organization, co-op.
It's a different set or different way of thinking. So I could see that's a learning curve for people going into something, having not necessarily being compensated for every little aspect or in the same way that you would just going to, like, a wage job for somebody else where you're more disconnected. And it has a different, I guess, a different hierarchy structure.
And you think about the cost benefit, you know, it's like, okay, you have more time reading, more time voting, investing in the co-op, but now you have access to an additional fleet vehicle or an additional farmer with a skill set that could come onto your site and help you with water systems. So like, there is benefit, right? It just comes at the cost of that more time investment, which is, I think it's fair, right? Because otherwise you'd have to invest it on your own to study it or save money for it. As opposed to reaching out to your network, organizing and scheduling it so that it works out for them as, like, a learning opportunity and you as an additional labor or additional support in something that needs to get done.
It's a matter of kind of developing those new skill sets and means of communication.
Yeah.
And with our biggest hurdle being money, you know, we also hope to keep money here in Humboldt. You know, I think a lot of just individuals and businesses, we bleed money out of Humboldt because we're buying a lot of, you know, big industrial things. And, you know, with co-ops and seed-to-table opportunities like we're trying to create, we're really giving an opportunity to keep our money here in the community. to start, you know, hoarding it in a sense.
Yeah.
So that we can have basic livable wages. You know, where it's not a lot to ask for, but it's such a huge hurdle for us at the same time to make sure kids are fed, to make sure people can put, you know, healthy food on the table. And if we can get access for our farmers, for our knowledge bearers to grow the things they know, to take back, you know, tortillas are sold everywhere.
Yeah.
But none of us are getting any money from it. None of us are able to spend the time doing the things we love, making tortillas, making masa, because it doesn't pay yet, you know?
Yeah.
So the co-op really gives us an opportunity to use our cultural skills to recreate the things that we love, while also giving opportunity to build up Humboldt's community, build up our food sovereignty by keeping our economic power here rather than redistributing it out.
Yeah, I feel like that's, it plays into a pattern in the history of Humboldt post-colonization, of this boom and bust economy of extracting from our natural resources. And you think about how Humboldt, I feel like, has gone through a couple stages of having a high value export, which has helped build the county through a few waves. I would think about like the first wave of natural extraction that happened here in the 1850s, and then the logging that happened again, that helped build a lot of infrastructure out here in between bust periods of economic depression. And same again with the cannabis industry, and now that has largely left this area, and we're in another one of those bust situations. And so it's tough, but it creates opportunities too. And it creates opportunities to do things better and learn from mistakes of the past and those extractive or exploitative means of creating that value that helped build infrastructure out here. But find what I like to call something else.
Locally speaking, I think it's also, you know, it's we have that rare... you know, what happened here with the Western expansion, you know, Manifest Destiny. This was the most Western area that colonization touched. And then it was so mountainous, too, that
right.
Our local indigenous communities are still, you know, were able to survive and still live. You know, some communities still live in their traditional fishing grounds where they, you know, they're still connected to their... to their land and to their cultures up here in a strong way. And I think, you know, growing here, you know, you start to reflect on that, especially being, you know, a brown person, where you're like, oh, these are my cousins and this is how they're doing it up here.
Mm-hmm.
And it for me, it created a curiosity on how, like, what's my indigeneity? What are my systems? What's my culture? And for, I feel like for our folks that have been colonized over in Mexico, our traditions and our culture and our morals are, they're kind of seated in between, you know, our modern culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's about, and for me, it was about like dissecting and finding out, you know, this aspect of indigeneity. And one of those things has been, you know, taking care of each other. Being fair, you know, ensuring that, you know, that your community is well, because, you know, your child's home is not just your home, the walls, the confines of your walls, it's also outside, it's your neighbor, you know, and we're all connected. And, you know, when you work with corn, you also see that, because if your neighbor's growing GMO, you're going to get some GMO in your corn. And so, you know, I feel like these are also indigenous teachings, the fact that we have to take care of each other and we have to look out for one another, and that the only way that we can grow as a community is through working together and, you know, respecting one another.
Yeah, and respecting the infrastructure that's being built up here on the North Coast, like the food hubs.
Mm.
You know, the NCJ has a food hub, now Hoopa has a food hub. And then that's tapping into feed distribution networks. So as a farmer, it's great to know that we could reach out to the family resource centers, Food for People. You know, there's entities that have funding to buy this food to make it available to these regions. And, you know, I learned from Megan that, you know, the farmers that are producing here in Humboldt County, they're not just, you know, selling their food to our immediate borders. Like, we're going as far as Trinity and Del Norte County, because although there's land there, the food just doesn't grow the same. We have established roots here, and finding those networks of where that food is necessary is important, right? And so as we're growing this food, knowing that it's going to these avenues that have already been laid out through a lot of extensive work and networking and you know, resource mapping, here we are as one of the, you know, people, one of the entities that want to contribute to that food distribution network system that is continuing to grow here on the North Coast.
Yeah, we're at a cool spot in time with the North Coast where we could see food sovereignty, you
mm-hmm.
know. It's something that's on everyone's minds and everyone's
mm-hmm.
pushing for, and, you know, I think that's why we get a lot of support as well, is because it's possible, you know. Bean and corns, you can feed everyone, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I see this as something I've hear over and over, which is our strength and our challenge out here is our isolation. It's partially why I moved out here 5 or 6 years ago, was because I wanted to live near the Lost Coast and the Redwoods and all these places in nature that compared to the East Coast seem like untouched. And then you learn about the history out here, you realize that's not necessarily true. But compared to the East Coast, this is like, yeah, untouched or whatever. But our challenge being isolated out here is also our strength, in that it creates more opportunity for local farmers to sell their produce when it's harder to get produce from out of here. I know that's why there's always been a push at certain points along the 101 to get it expanded to be
mm-hmm.
wider,
mm-hmm.
to allow larger trucks in so we can have more Sysco and more large food distributors coming in. And, you know, I just heard you all talking about North Coast food sovereignty a lot, and I feel like the Humboldt Bay is kind of the hub of the North Coast. It's maybe the most densely populated place before you get to, I don't know, going north all the way up to the Grants Pass and going south maybe to, it's maybe like, what, 6 or 7 hours in any direction to get to somewhere more populated
mm-hmm.
than the Humboldt Bay. And
mm-hmm.
then in between that, it's very sparsely populated, but there are networks. There's many towns, though, small
mm-hmm.
little tiny towns and networks of farmers and amazing little microclimates and amazing little soil pockets along our rivers. And so I think it creates that opportunity as well with our low population. It's actually feasible for the ratio out here of how many farmers we have for how kind of sparsely populated this place is compared to many other places. It's feasible for local farmers to grow enough food to supply a large amount of our local food system. It's just, I think, a matter right now of this middle of the supply chain infrastructure and setting up these networks, getting people to talk to each other. So having the facilities, the storage, the processing, the transportation, and then also having enough groups on the same page, enough groups that are, I guess, sharing this value of building this food system, not necessarily just an economic bottom line of just make money,
mm-hmm.
But having a more of a vision for a future beyond just creating a profit.
I mean, when those systems continue to get laid out, you know, I just see it being more advantageous for farmers. So now you have farmers that can tap into these networks and, you know, sell their food whole,
mm-hmm.
and not have to go to a market or drive to a grocery store.
Yeah.
Right? And so when we streamline these things, it's also, you know, we're reducing our carbon footprint, you know, by not making everyone do it on their own. And
mm-hmm.
so it's just great to know that investing in agriculture is not just us doing this because we think it will work and we think it's a good idea. It's our part in the great idea that has been happening up here, which is reincorporating these, you know, ancestral practices and like regenerative farming techniques into the longevity of
yeah.
what the food network and infrastructure and system will be up here on the North Coast.
I love how one of the things I like about up here is how people, almost everybody out here, values nature to some degree. Where I grew up, there were a lot of people who weren't very even aware nature existed. And out here, everybody has something that they could not, some aspect of nature out here they couldn't imagine their lives without. And I think that speaks to a lot of the support you see for regenerative farming practices and indigenous farming practices, which are very much regenerative. And I want to talk a bit about your farms and the work being done on them. I understand you do some work parties. Can I... what's up with the work parties? Because they look like a lot of fun and a lot of work.
Yeah, the work parties are created because there is just... It's just so much work to produce food, and you know, physical labor, your body breaks down, especially as you're older.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, it was, I was seeing in like some of the aunties and uncles, and just they're kind of getting in their old age,
yeah,
and knowing that they aren't able to, they might not be growing corn this year because they just had, you know, some things that kind of got in the way, and now they would have to, you know, haul ass to get everything done, but they're at an age where they can't do that. So but having a work party, having a labor force for a day or for a day of every month or something like that,
mm-hmm.
it makes it more accessible for them to continue their traditions. And so that's kind of like the general idea is to create a resource that's based off of the community's efforts to help raise farmers and to help them get whatever they need to get them, you know, that year. And it's been so beautiful to see all the food that has been made at all the work parties. Mm. And because this is also another aspect of our project, which is, you know, having our, giving our tradition, our traditional culinary arts, a space to grow, to continue to create more chefs,
mm-hmm.
To give an opportunity to our folks that, you know, might not see any value in their culture because of the racism, because of their dark skin,
because
mm-hmm. the way that, you know, our communities are financially. But yeah, this is an opportunity to create this something to be proud of and something that is worth based off of their traditional cultures. So it's been really beautiful to see all of us just in general even starting to dig into like these old recipes, old processes,
right?
You know, like nixtamalization, like understanding that.
Yeah.
Having each individual in the community that participates in our work parties or just as a farmer understand nixtamalization, you know, through an elder, you know, through an auntie that a tia that, you know, is there in our community, giving her a space to get paid to teach us and to have community around her.
Mm-hmm.
It's been beautiful to see how the work parties have incorporated that aspect of culinary arts, you know, because every work party we have food, and which gives an opportunity to one of our members to kind of host it, you know, or
right.
to practice.
And I see that as a way of expressing what you were talking about before with having the values of the co-op be more than the values of a traditional business, maybe. It's not just about, you think, oh, work party, like, okay, am I just going to have to, like, go plant something for hours and then go home and be tired? Like, no, it really is a party, and it's not just about the quote-unquote work of agricultural work, but, like, the role of who's cooking, the role of the knowledge bearers. There's always kids, so there's the role of who's going to play with the kids. Like, that's my role at every family reunion. Mm-hmm. And to also be able to pay someone, though, is huge as well, because it's one thing to be compensated just through respect and praise, but to have that put into monetary value on top of that respect and praise kind of recognizes any maybe financial struggle or hardship that comes with having it not recognized in that way. And so I love that you can do that, and you can make it like a fun, positive experience for people. And I think that's another thing too, like, over generations of agricultural work becoming more exploitative and more a thing that parents don't want to see their kids doing, because of maybe what they went through doing it or what their ancestors went through doing it, giving people an opportunity to make it a positive thing.
Mm. And with our work parties, you know, it's an opportunity. Farming is a really lonely thing. Having talked to farmers out here, we're all very isolated.
Mm. Yeah.
And a lot of us, it's just, you know, one person struggling to do the whole thing. So, and then on the opposite end, there's a lot of people in the towns like Arcata and Eureka where they don't have the space they want. So it was really exciting to be able to put these two groups of people together, where people who are like, I want to get my hands in the dirt so bad.
Mm-hmm.
And to give them the opportunity to return to the same space every single month and really feel a connection with that land space has been really special. And especially, you know we can't pay volunteers because money's the bottom line. It's our ceiling that we just can't get through.
Mm-hmm.
But we can share what we're growing. You know, there's always this ability to skip over the money, and it's like, oh, you came and you worked these hours and you committed to being a part of this year's process. Of course you get corn or masa or, you know, it
nettles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's all sorts of things we've harvested, herbs and wild nettles.
Well, aside the tangible, you get community experience, you know? You get to be part of the offering.
Yeah. And I think speaking on that, like, the most important thing to me is that people get to experience a way of being that isn't necessarily available to them. Because once you feel that thing that's different, once you experience it, it's hard to go back. You know, you spend the day out with people in the field, like, it's such a joyous feeling, such a right feeling. It's like, oh, this is how my days could be. Mm-hmm. Like, this is how I want every day. And you can't undo that once you feel that. You know, because then you're always going to strive for it because you felt it that one time.
Yeah.
And that's the driver of change in the long run, is experiencing the change.
I can totally relate to that. My best years farming are the years where it's been a great crew. Mm. And you see that not just in farming, but even at, like, workplaces. Yeah. You can go to a Pizza Hut and be like, if everyone happens to look like real good friends behind the counter there, you're like, oh, this looks like a great place to work.
And to eat.
And then I've had
Now the salad bar looks good.
Yeah. And I've also had the flip side of being, like, in the most beautiful, amazing farm country out there, but I'm by myself. And it's like, and my best company is like the sheep and my pet rooster, and it like it just it's horrible. It's kind of it makes it real sad when you're doing such a beautiful thing but you can't share it with people, and then it's impossible to do it on your own, and so that it's not sustainable either.
And a lot of farmers are doing other jobs and have kids, and it's just, it feels impossible.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, to me, a community work party is like gestalt theory in practice. It's like the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and everything that is offered is like not necessarily tangible, but it can be, right? Like a closer connection with someone you're farming with, you know, like what you're learning on the land, like what working on the land does for you, right? Touching the soil, being there, being in community. There, people start to realize the similarities that other people who are on that land for the same reason have. That proximity builds intimacy and closeness. And then it's like you're continuing that work, right? You know that when you leave, that work will continue to go on and carry further things like crops or educational workshops or whatever. But you were part of that. You know, and knowing that like really does bring value to the people who go. And so I could go out and farm by myself for, you know, 6 or 8 hours, you know, come home, rest, eat. Or I could go out, invite a crew of a dozen people out who want to be there. We could work for 2 hours, get the same amount of work done. And now we also have this sense of community, this sense of like solidarity, you know, like, and that is a lot of the value. Like a lot of the people that want to come out to the Hoopa site, they want to go out not to get paid, but to be there, to see it in see it operate, and to see like that work get done, and to be part of that work because they're able-bodied, because they have time, because it feels valuable to them, not because I'm convincing them, hey, there's value here.
Right.
And so it hasn't been hard to find the right people to go out there because it's like, like I said, it's the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Like, yes, you could go there to just weed, but you're not just getting the benefit of weeding. You're getting the benefit of being part of the great bigger image of like what is happening on that land, why it's happening,
yeah,
and what it's part of.
That also brings like opportunities where, you know, some folks start thinking, oh, well, maybe I should make this dish, you know, that I've been, you know, kind of trying to recreate. Creates an opportunity for stuff like that. Or like, oh, how do I make this better? Maybe, because sometimes I go and I never even touched the soil.
Yeah.
And then I'm, because I'm just watching the baby, and I'm like, well, yeah, I can cook. And then I ended up, you know, cooking or something. But also, you know, for me, it also I start thinking, well, maybe I could take a band up there. And then I'm like, oh, let me gather some musicians so we could go up there and we can have a place to practice and just kind of build, you know, that, that community, build the different resources that, you know, like, or how I said earlier that the land is the basis of our indigenous cultures, and you know, so we're coming back to it. We're coming back to the land, and now trying to build up these little, you know, little different parts of the, of the society. You know,
it's like people aren't used to labor not being alienating. Like people aren't used to having a workplace be the third space, or necessarily a public third space. They're used to it being somewhere you have to audition to get into. You have to apply and be interviewed, and you have to be the best of all the people that applied.
Yeah.
And then you can go and get money in exchange for doing.
And then you got to go and check your ego.
Yeah.
That takes a lot of work.
I mean, it comes down to communal land tending for me, of going back to this ancient practice where you can plant 5 acres in a day because you have 15 people who know what they're doing. And, you know, you do it once and for the year and you come back together. It just, it's a whole different way of being through the year. You're changing with the seasons and you move together, which is just, I don't know. That's the dream. Have a crew and spend the day farming with them, you know?
I like that, move together. Like that's how people did it forever up until kind of industrialization kind of put us all in our own little work cubicles, so to speak. Yeah, I love the social media posts I've seen from the work parties. They look like a lot of fun. They really do look like a party.
They are.
So if people want to get involved in a work party or any aspect of Akili Metzli, how can they do that?
They could just follow us on Instagram at Akili Metzli. Can reach out to any of us.
Put that in the show notes.
Yeah. We have a website now.
Nice.
You could come by La Ciendita. So I'm the owner with my wife, La Ciendita. And whenever we're open, someone can connect you to Akili Metzli. That's how a couple of our members have mm-hmm. found out about the group.
Mm-hmm.
Right on. And that's, for our listeners, that's where we're recording right now. And it is right next to the fire station in Arcata. Right?
Across the street from Sushi Spot.
Yeah, across the street from Sushi Spot, mm-hmm. next to the plaza. It's an awesome little spot, so please come on by if you want to check it out or get involved or talk to anyone from Akili Metzli.
We're looking for people who want to help grow corn next year mm-hmm. or who have land that they would like to have a milpa grown mm-hmm. on.
For Hupa specifically, we would love a local successor, someone who is from Hupa,
mm-hmm.
that would love to take over some of the operations that we are starting in that area. Since a lot of our efforts are to keep the food in Hupa, we feel like it's only right to, you know, bring that energy to that region and that valley that grows so much amazing food.
Yeah.
But in the last, you know, 5 years or so, it seems like there hasn't been enough energy or oomph or young, new energy to take over some of that. And so as we've been listening right to the land and to the people who steward that land and the waterways, they're excited to see us there and we're happy to be there. However, we also want to make sure that we're building, right? That people can see that as an opportunity to invest in an area that needs that, right? So if you're connected to river families, and if you're hearing this, there's space for you at the Hupa site. There is an abundance of opportunity there ready to be handed to you if you are receptive and willing to meet us where the land wishes to be met, and as we're, you know, trying to be in good relationship with the land and the people there.
That's awesome stuff.
And this is a bigger movement than just Akili Metzli. You know, this is a whole food sovereignty movement here mm-hmm. in Humboldt. And I think, you know, we need more co-ops. We need a whole co-op, like regional co-op economy. We need to fill
yeah.
in these economic gaps. And this is something that's a call to action in itself, to look at the economy, see where is our money leaking out? How do we fill those holes with co-ops that help us create, you know, that horizontal community owned for the community,
mm-hmm.
You know, like chicken feed. It's a huge thing that we're spending money on.
Yeah,
how do we grow it here in Humboldt? You know, mm-hmm. basic things like that is really the call that we need to be able to create a resilient food system here.
Right, like make your own. It doesn't necessarily have to be a co-op, but you're like different from that, those ways of thinking or systems that have got people into these unsustainable models, and making your own, again, like something else.
Yeah. And basic things that the industry's already there. There's already
mm-hmm.
money being put into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're buying soil or whatever from... I mean, usually that's local. That's maybe not the best. But
lucky there, yeah.
Yeah. But it would be easy to just transition the manufacturer to local, to do it on a smaller scale, because we are a smaller place, and that gives us that,
yeah.
that opportunity, because we don't have to be on the same scale as San Francisco or LA.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I also noticed that, you know, I worked in different, you know, bigger organizations, and just the tendency to always shop at Michael's or at, you know, Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
Even at my job right now, today I reminded someone where it's like, oh, we're going to give gift cards to Walmart. And it's like, well, aren't there any, like, local businesses? I know that, you know, our community might be used to those, but
mm-hmm.
if we're giving out incentives, it's also an opportunity to provide some education on local businesses. And so if, you know, if you're not in an office and you have nothing to do with the milpas or growing food, but you're interested in supporting, you know, ensuring that whenever there's any money coming in to the county, that it's spent locally, that you know, invest in understanding, you know, your local vendors, whether it's cultural crafts or art supplies, and you know, I think one thing we're talking about also is producing our own cal, which is the calcium hydroxide. It's a key part of the nixtamalization process,
mm-hmm.
and how do we produce that, and you know, we have some experiments on the way, which is also kind of, you know, we can touch on a little bit on the education factor of this, of Akili Metsi. You know, we're trying to ensure that our young folks, or you know, older folks, have access to experiments, have access to, you know, research and labs. You know, we're working with the university now, a couple of professors, and we're excited to create these educational and scientific opportunities for students that can, you know, also maybe render some, you know, new business owners that, you know, might come out of that, or, you know, developing new industries. So, yeah, we're just excited about that too. Sorry, I just wanted to drop into education.
No, it's, I mean, it's true. I mean, like, the byproduct might look like you go to a Mexican restaurant and the corn from the pozole or the chips are from, you know, a local masa producer like Akili Metzli. That would be an awesome byproduct. Mm-hmm. But the impact is bigger than that. You know, it's knowing that the economy is getting better because that money's staying here,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that people are willing to make those investments for that higher grade. Because it's more culturally appropriate, it's more representative of the foods that these culture bearers have come into these regions to start restaurants, to share this food, to share this knowledge. So the impact is greater, right? Like everything Octavio just laid out, you know, like that's the impact. But you might see it as like, oh, nice, these chips taste better.
Yeah.
But why the chips mm-hmm. taste better is the big thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I love the mentioning of like, you know, these opportunities to incentivize people to enter like the shop local, the buy local, because that isn't what, you know, as an immigrant family, we want to buy cheap,
mm-hmm.
you know, we want to buy available, you know, but making sure that sector of the community has that invitation to help us grow our community the way we want to see it grown is huge, right?
Yeah.
And it's really like, the impact of what is going to happen with the Akili Metsi Masa Co-op.
And I just did a interview with Megan from NCGA on the Food Hub, and she was speaking a bit about that, about how there are people who order from the Food Hub at prices that are higher than conventional prices, that what you might pay a larger distributor like Sysco or something like that, but they see the value in it for, like, it tastes better. It's a little bit fresher. But they also see the value of keeping that money in the community and supporting a local farm and supporting that work and our local economy.
Mm-hmm. Fix our economy one economy man at a time, you know, or economy person at a time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, that person can then spend more within their economy, and so it cycles, right?
Right.
And it starts to, like, avalanche and build on itself.
Especially thinking about like Sysco and other food producers, you know, in this country, food is grown by Latinx people.
Yeah.
And at Akili Metsli, we're trying to not be farm workers exploited anymore. We want to be the farm owners. We want to be in charge of growing the food that our community is already growing,
mm-hmm.
but we want to be able to survive and live, not, you know, as excess the government has to take care of or the farmer has to take care of. You know, we want to be seen as people who have the knowledge and skills to do the labor that we are already doing.
Right.
We want to control our supply chain.
Yeah.
Yeah, and own your labor.
Own our labor.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're coming up to the end here. I want to say thank you all so much for taking the time to talk to me and educating me and all our listeners on Akili Metsli. Just want to reiterate, if people want to get involved, there's so many ways you can get involved. You can join work parties, you can stop by La Ciendida, you can just shop local when you're shopping for anything, or even specifically traditional foods. And so you can reach out to Akili Metsli at their social media, their Instagram page, and their website will be linked in the show notes. And there will also be a link to if you want to upload any questions or comments about the podcast. And Until then, keep supporting local food systems and good food. Check, mic check.
Yeah, I hear that mic works real good.
Check it, check.
Check it, check.